Welcome back to another Meet Kevin Report. We're on episode 117. We've also brought back the shadowing program. We finally caught up and gotten back to a place where we can open up shadowing again. So if you're interested in shadowing with me, where you kind of see what I do behind the scenes, you can do that via the link down below. Whether we're local, in the office, we travel, whatever. It's shadowing. It's pretty awesome. Check it out. Link down below. Regarding the Federal Reserve, we're going to be talking about them today, as well as why it seems like stocks are always red in the morning. This is an interesting pattern that I've been observing, and I thought to myself, golly, you know, after market hours, the stock market tends to continue to trend up as we get this rally into the close, and then you get this green after hours. Then early in the morning, you look, like an hour ago I was looking, and it seemed like everything was down substantially more than it even is now. And then I looked around a little bit, and it seemed like the S&P 500, from the opening bell to close, for 6 days straight, has basically rallied. And it's kind of interesting, because the last time we saw something like this was in October of 2021, which was basically the peak of the market back then, coming up to November of 2021. I don't know if you could really correlate the two and say that, oh, okay, because the peak then also had these sort of straight rallies into the close is again what we're seeing here. But it is interesting that consistently we seem to open lower and close higher. Personally, I think that's because of massive misallocation. And that's actually going to intro our first piece today, where we talk about this massive misallocation and what that could actually do, especially to bonds, which is pretty remarkable. So we'll talk about that. In the meantime, though, we're at a little bit of a bumped probability here on a 25 basis point hike for the Fed. We're at about 89.3% now for a 25 BP hike in July. That is up from 88%, so slight little nudge up after the minutes. And we did end up bumping to 73.6%, also up about a percent on staying at about a 25 BP hike for September. If we jump on over to the 5-year break even, I really wanted to see what would happen after the minutes here and after sort of a nearly full day went by. And we did see the 5-year break even pop down a tiny little bit, but it's still stable around that 2.21 level. So again, it's my thesis that you've got to see that level come down to about 1.6, 1.7 before the Fed can actually cut rates, which somewhat implies that we're not really close yet. We've still got quite a ways to go on when the Federal Reserve might actually be in a position to cut. Okay. Let's talk about positioning and what's going on with the bond market. So here we go. Let's get that ready. 1 second. All right. So, okay. And there we go. All right. Folks, the 10-year Treasury yield is going bonkers again. It's knocking on the door of 4%, something we haven't seen until after we got the January hot data from an unseasonably warm winter where a lot of retail sales were being pulled forward. The only reason we dipped with the 10-year Treasury in March was, well, of course, the banking crisis where we had a rapid deceleration of interest rates. And then, of course, the time before that was October, November, before the real December sell-off that we saw in the stock market where we had a 4% 10-year Treasury yield. In fact, as I was recording this, this just popped from the upper three nines to over 4%. So what's going on and why might these yields be going up? And what could it mean for the stock market? And is there a giant irony happening? I personally believe there is. So we'll look a little bit at positioning, but I want you to think about logic here first, and then we'll get into some equity research from Jefferies and some other sources. So let's think about logic first. What does it mean when a bond yield rises? Well, usually when a bond yield rises, what you have is you have more people selling that particular bond than you have people buying it. So when you have more selling, you increase the yield because the price is lower. So if the yield is constant and the price goes down, you get a higher percentage on your money. But why would people be selling bonds? Well, I have a theory. I think people might be selling bonds because they're realizing they're under-allocated to stocks. Now, that's actually really interesting because it suggests a reiteration of what we've seen in the stock market over especially the last 6 days with the S&P, where you get this morning sell-off or low, and then you rise into the close. It seems to me institutional investors are potentially vastly mispositioned, and every bit of negative news is seen as an opportunity to increase their positioning to equities and reduce their positioning to bonds. Because even though you're getting a nice juicy 4-5% yield on the 10-to-2-year treasury yields, you're missing out on the potential returns of the stock market. And most institutional investors thought 2023 was going to be horrible. We were going to have Chinese reinflation with the Chinese reopening that was going to push inflation up throughout the rest of the world. Earnings were supposed to be the worst, and the stock market was supposed to sell down even more as a result of this wild earnings recession. Well, we didn't end up getting that kind of pain in 2023. We got a substantially stronger economy with stronger sales in January, stronger sales in February, powered through the banking crisis, potentially with the help of Powell. Although that could reignite as bond yields continue to rise, you actually put more stress on the banks, so you could see more of the Fed's liquidity facilities being tapped because of this. And we have been, right? If you look at the Bank Term Funding Program of the Federal Reserve, and we can pull up charts by going to the St. Louis Fed on that, you can see that liquidity for this facility has generally been trending up. Let's zoom in on it here really quick, and here it is. So you can see here is the banking crisis in March. We shot up with our usage of this bank term funding program. We kind of leveled out, but then come May, as the 10-year treasury started rising again, you started seeing that pressure again. Now we've started flattening again here in just the last few weeks of June, which is good, a sign of stability. But what could all of this actually mean going forward? And then what does Jeffrey say? Well, consider this for a moment. If it is possible that you end up with an institutional set that is under-allocated, that is, people are underweight stocks, which the Bank of America Fund Manager Survey told us, hey, we're underweight stocks, right? Bank of America Fund Survey said, institutional fund managers are underweight 32% on their stocks. Well, then any dip opportunity is an opportunity to buy and allocate and dump bonds, which would actually lead to an environment, and this is the crazy part, where you potentially have yields up, stocks up. Usually you don't have that. Usually when yields are up, stocks go down. But now we're potentially in this environment where yields are going up, stocks are going up because of this rebalancing combined with obviously where the Fed has rates right now. Now, let's take a look at this. Jefferies put together a piece here and indicated that looking at the MSCI hedge fund data as of 4:30, April 30th, and this piece just came out as well, but this just came out yesterday here, July 5th. These investors increased their long position to 230%, back above long-term averages. These investors, look at this, lowered weight in bond proxies, underweight group by over 10%, now net short real estate and utilities. Secular growth was bumped to overweight. So many different types of institutions here, but consider this. You've got fund managers, which are your investment advisors. So these are your financial advisors allocating money for people. Then you have hedge funds. So hedge funds are not actually, they can be, but they're usually not licensed financial advisors. They're just people who are putting money together for accredited investors. You've kind of already started to see that transition for hedge funds. They went from under-allocated at the beginning of the year to starting to get over-allocated as soon as around the end of April. And that could have been one of the reasons we've seen bond yields rise up. Now you need to see fund managers also play catch up. And I think people are realizing that you just can't be short equities right now, or you can't be under allocated. And therefore, you've got here hedge funds raising their equity exposure back above long-term average. Let's take a look at some of the others here. Hedge funds moved back to net short and marginally short on net short real estate, marginally short in utilities. I do want to mention what this could mean for real estate, by the way. When you have this sort of environment, by the way, yields up, stocks up, you're actually going to create a very interesting opportunity. Usually what's going to happen is stocks TINA returns for stocks. TINA returns is there is no alternative. And that basically says everyone piles into stocks. There's a beauty in that. As real estate rents decline, as they are, real estate becomes less desirable. As mortgage rates and yields rise, guess what? Real estate becomes less desirable, which means much less competition and more opportunity in real estate, because every loser on Wall Street isn't trying to understand real estate and just buy a bunch of properties everywhere. So in my opinion, this actually sets up fantastic opportunities to ride stocks for a bit and then get into real estate as potentially more opportunities open up over the next 6 months to a year, couple of years, in that sort of window. That's sort of what I've been playing and sort of knocking on wood on since January of 2022. The idea of allocate to stocks before the PIV, and then real estate lags, so allocate to real estate after. Kind of interesting. So, okay, now let's continue with this Jefferies piece. Speaking of real estate, by the way, if you want to shadow me as I hunt for real estate, we brought back the shadowing program, link down below. You can shadow me and learn from me in person on real estate. That's, of course, or linked right next to the links for the courses on building your wealth, link down below. All right, so continuing with the Jefferies piece here. So we continue to track and write about our version of FANG Plus, called the Sweet 16. As of the end of April, hedge funds took down their active weight to this group and moved to a larger underweight. The underweight versus the S&P 500 stands at 5.1 versus 3.3% the month prior. So in other words, when you're looking at the top 16 stocks, even though hedge funds have positioned in by about April 30th, in recent weeks, you've started to get back to a little bit underweight. You could see that represented by this red line here. It's really, as we kind of wrote here, hedgies are hit or miss with you know, tech, basically. They're not sure, like, do we love it? Do we hate it? Where do we want to be? And so here's the 0% line, if you see my little swiggly laser right there. And when you get this red line here going under that zero line right there on the right, you're getting that under allocation again. Which is actually fantastic, because it just reiterates why we're potentially seeing these runs of the stock market into the close. Remember, stocks, at least the S&P 500, has run into the close 6 days in the row now, and we haven't seen that since October of 2021. And it's usually a sign of, I mean, I hate to use this phrase, but it might be accurate here, institutional FOMO, where you're kind of just getting this allocation because they realize they've oopsie-doopsied, right? and been misallocated. Hedge funds got less defensive and cut their exposure to bond proxies by almost 5%. Underweight bond proxies now stands at 10.2%. However, the historical average is higher than 11. In other words, they're historically more underweight, which means there's more bond selling to do and more allocating to stocks to do. Now, Augustine here in the chat actually asks a good question. How does this relate to the 10-2 yield curve? Okay, so I said something mean yesterday about economists and the 10-2 yield curve, and it could end up like biting me in the butt, but I thought it was funny. I don't know, maybe other people didn't think it was funny, but I'll show you this tweet, and it relates to answering your question, which I think is actually a very valid question. So first, I quote tweeted this person. This person says, quote, "Son, I got a new job. Mom got a raise. We have more cash in the bank. Gas prices are falling. My 401k is up. Your 529 college savings plan is up. And my company is expanding thanks to growing profits. But, son, We're not going to Disney World because the yield curve is inverted. Said nobody ever. And I thought it was a great comment because the truth is, the biggest bear argument right now is the 10-2 yield curve. This idea that, oh my gosh, you know, but the yield curve is inverting. The yield curve being inverted, I know that sounds complicated, but it's really not. Let me show you how simple it is to see that the yield curve is inverted. You ready? You go here, search, you put in 10-year. So all I'm doing is going to CNBC.com. I put in 10-year on one tab, and then I put in 2-year on the other tab. And so what do you do? Right here on the 10-year, you see, okay, we're at 4%. Okay, that's easy math. Here on the 2-year, you see you're at 5%. What's the difference? About 1%. Because usually you get paid more for committing your money for longer, this is the opposite of what you would expect. You would expect the 10-year to be higher and the 2-year to be shorter or lower, but it's not. Hence, you have an inversion. There are two potential explanations for this. One, we're screwed and we're going into a deep, dark recession like history has predicted. Although there have been false flags on this. Like, if you look at the history of the inverted yield curve, every time there has been a recession, you've had an inversion of the yield curve. But not every time you've had an inversion have you had a recession. Anyway, the second possible explanation is that because inflation is high now, people are demanding a higher basically yield in order to commit to 2-year treasuries now because they want to be paid more now. And they realize that high inflation isn't going to last long, so they're willing to take slightly less on the longer duration bond because inflation is expected to go down. So anyway, I ended up replying to this. I quote tweeted this. It wasn't as popular as I thought. I thought it was funny, but it wasn't. I don't know. I said, hence why economists have predicted 10 out of the last 2 recessions, the actual 10-2 inversion, which is basically to say that maybe the real 10-2 inversion is the fact that we're predicting more recessions than we actually get. Anyway, so point of all this is there is a logical explanation to the 10-2 yield curve. Yes, it is a very legitimate bearish argument. And maybe you know, it's wrong to say that the 10-2 yield curve is completely wrong. And I don't want to suggest that it's completely wrong, but I'm just saying there is a logical explanation as well, which is scary because it makes sense that if you're underallocated bonds, you start dumping bonds in a high interest rate regime for anybody to buy the 2-year, you need to see yields continue to go up above the 10-year. And then as people are dumping bonds, they're actually throwing money into stocks because stocks are rising again. And we're realizing even though earnings estimates have been adjusted down, things just aren't as bad as they were expected to be in 2022. The economy just continues to show signs of strength. Anyway, okay, a little bit more on the hedge funds here. So I want to see where they're crowded. Here we go. Uber crowded names loved by hedge funds. This is the order of crowded names for hedge funds. Meta, Microsoft, Nvidia, Amazon, Visa, Adobe, Netflix, Evolent Health, McDonald's, Lulu, Lind, Google, Booking Holdings, AMD, Pepsi, Salesforce, PayPal, Intuitive, Procter & Gamble, and United Health. Notice no Tesla. No Tesla, no Apple. Oh, that's really interesting, actually. Make a little note of that. Tesla, Apple, not here. You also don't have your TSM, your ASML. Oh, by the way, I had the honor of driving to the TSM plant yesterday, which was pretty cool. In Phoenix, we were looking at real estate and studying the rental market there. Here's the Phoenix, Arizona plant as of yesterday. I was talking about how it's really crazy that the Inflation Reduction Act is probably paying like 25 to 30% of all of this, which is remarkable. I actually ended up flying over the plant as well, which is also really cool. So we kind of got a lowish fly over the plant. I mean, that's probably, 4,000 feet or whatever, which is pretty cool. But anyway, yeah, that was pretty awesome. So point of all of this is really, here, one more chart and then bottom line this. So Infotech net positioning, you could see here again, I will draw a line at that 0% so you could see it a little bit easier. You could see that negative, that underweight positioning there by hedge funds again in tech. And you can see it oscillates a lot, you know, but that's what hedge funds do. They trade a lot. But anyway, point of this is this Jefferies piece reiterates that funds are underallocated stocks. And when they allocate more to stocks, what do? They dump bonds. What happens when you dump bonds? You jack up the yield curve. And it really reiterates essentially exactly what we're seeing. Just pretty remarkable. So anyway, that gives us a thought about yield curve and stocks. All right. Next up. All right. So that was about the yield curve. Now let's look at ADP jobs. I honestly thought ADP jobs, I make this mistake like every month. It's my fault. I think the data comes out at 5:30. It actually comes out at 5:15. And it's like, really? who picks 5:15? What is this crap? But you get jobless data that comes out at 5:30. So we'll get to cover that right now. Okay. All right, let me make a quick note of that. Okie dokie, okie dokie. Take a sip of coffee here. Oh my god. This is insane. Hold on one sec. Alright. Okay, cool. And we got initial jobless claims and everything as well. So here we go. Well, another jobs insane surprise. It is one day, of course, before the official BLS jobs report, but we have a private jobs report that likes to give us a heads up, as well as unemployment claims and continuing claims and JOLTS numbers. We like all of this data so that we can try to understand what's going on in the economy. The JOLTS data coming out later today is expected to come in at 9.9 million, but what did we just get? We just got continuing claims. Continuing claims are a sign of how many people are unemployed, who are looking for work, and when the number goes down, it's a sign that they got a job, which is a sign the economy is still willing to absorb people who maybe lost their job and are now looking for a new job. We were expecting, survey says, 1.737 million continuing claims. We actually got 1.720, so a miss again on continuing claims. Not only did we miss on continuing claims, though, but last week we revised down the number by another 9,000. So in other words, strong jobs market. However, we did see initial jobless claims tick up a little bit to 248,000 versus the survey of 245,000, as reported just minutes ago. That 3,000 beat, though, was offset by a 3,000 reduction last week. So really, that's like six of one, half dozen of the other. No change there. I'll say initial jobless claims, basically no change. Continuing claims, a little bit lower. Great. But what did we just get with ADP? A blowout. An absolute blowout. So listen to this. We were expecting 225,000 jobs to be added in the month of June. What did we get? Look on screen now. It's a fat coupon code for the shadowing experience with Meet Kevin linked down below or the courses. Oh, it's actually the ADP report. 497,000 change in private employment. Job creation surged in June. Oh no. This is my fear. Led by consumer facing services. Oh no. That's your core. Remember Kevin's fear right now. Kevin's fear is that people are going to travel so much more than the seasonal adjustments are going to take into account. We're going to end up seeing core inflation rise, and people are going to lose their behinds, freaking out, thinking inflation is reanimating just because people are traveling more and spending more on leisure and hospitality. Anyway, leisure and hospitality, trade and transportation, education and health services showed strong gains. Still, the market was fragmented, with manufacturing, tech, and finance showing declines. Oops. Oh, dear Lord. Okay, so where are the numbers concentrated? Wow. Wow, that's actually very interesting. So it's the small businesses here, under 250 employees, that are adding like nutso, 160,000 for small. We just hired. First time ever, by the way. Never had this before. First time ever, just hired an in-house attorney. They're on, I don't know, like day like 8 or whatever. It's so cool. Like, it's awesome. It's like, who do you want to sue? It doesn't cost you anything. I'm just kidding. That's not the intention, right? We have compliance purposes and stuff, but it is kind of cool. Anyway, so, because ordinarily, like, let's say you are to get sued, you're like, crap, I got to hire an attorney and it's expensive and stuff. It's like, now it makes no difference. Anyway, 162,000 for small, 137,000 for 20 to 49 employees, 171,000 for 50 to 249. Small increase here for 250 to 499. How does that apply to large? Large, negative 8,000. Wow. This is actually really interesting. The big companies are not hiring as much. So consider that takeaway here for a moment. That's kind of incredible, actually. So what you have is you have over 250 employees not adding. I'm going to say not adding because you have a slight plus here and a minus on the other. I think that offsets. So really over 250 employees, you're not adding. It's the under 250K adding like a nutso, which makes sense because that's going to be more of your restaurants, your hotels, and all your related hospitality services, your wave runner rentals, your skydiving rentals. You know, your, oh man, it makes me want to go to the beach of Florida so badly. It's so warm and beautiful there. Anyway, I'm stuck in California. So what do we got in terms of specific sectors here? Manufacturing hit. You've got trade, transportation, utilities up 90,000. This is actually where we also saw some of that CPI heat. That was actually the biggest one of the biggest contributor of CPI pain over here. Then you've got, look at that, leisure and hospitality, 232,000. That one sector alone is bigger than the 225,000. That's nuts. We were looking at 225,000. We literally beat that solely with leisure and hospitality. Some Broccoli Bob. Oh, that's an interesting name. It's an alliteration. Says, who do you want to sue? Nobody. Boxable. No, never. Anyway, so, okay, let's keep looking here. I want to see the wage data, though. So, wage data. So, let's get the wage data. Yeah, mostly because when we look at the wage data, we can see how we're doing with any fears of a wage spiral, which we don't want. No, come on, where are the wage gains? Quite interesting, they're actually not indicated. Usually they're right at the bottom of this report. So I will continue to hunt for that. Anyway, let me see what Wall Street is saying for this and what this is going to do to our five-year break-evens. It's probably going to drive yields higher. It's probably going to reiterate the hike, which in my opinion does mean you could have a potential sell down in stocks. But honestly, it's a good thing. It just says we're that much further away from a recession. Like anybody who says, oh, I got it. Anybody who says this is bad wants the economy to go into a recession or something. It doesn't make sense. This is absolutely fantastic. Yeah, five-year break-even just ticked up a little bit. So you're at 2.22, 0.1% on an uptick here. Not a big deal whatsoever. So that's okay. I'm getting the wage data now. As far as the, let's look at the Fed term rate expectations. That way we could see if the market's trying to price in any more rate hikes beyond what we already have priced. So the Fed term rate right now sits at a juicy and delicious, oh yeah. Okay, we just shot up from 5.35 to 5.41. So the way that works is you have to think that another 25 BP hike would put us at about 5.37. Anything above 5.37, which is the midpoint between 5.25 and 5.5, anything above 5.37 implies a second rate hike. So this means we are now starting to price in a second rate hike. This, honestly though, who cares? Like, another 25 here, 25 there, I don't care. As long as we're not going into a recession, it just doesn't matter. You did just see another 3 percentage points added to the chance of a 25 BP hike for July. You're basically confirmed now, and you're still stable. No, you've added about 4% to the chance of a second hike in September. Yeah, okay, they shaved off the stay stable at 5. Okay, so now let's look at wages. So in the ADP report we have, here it is. Okay, we're going to compare this to the prior report because we want to see what's going on with wage gains. So this is very important. So we want to compare to the May report. ADP report for May last month. That was, let's see, there's the May release. That's the July release. Okay, well, let's just for now quickly compare to 2 months ago. We'll be able to see a little bit more transition if we go 2 months back. Okay, so I have both up here. So this here is now, and we're going to flip between the two. Ready for this? Job stayers, 6.4%. Go back 2 months, job stayers, 6.7%. So continued decline. Job changers, you're at 11.2%. And you were at 13.2% 2 months ago. Okay, good. And what about leisure and hospitality? You were at 8.9%. Now you're at, oh, thank goodness, 7.9%. You want to see that keep going down. Other services, 6.3, was 6.5. Good. Education went down. Professional business services, 6.2. That went up. You actually had a little bit of a sticky push here. I don't want to see that. Wait. No, sorry. Hold on a sec. Did I do that right? No, it went down one. Okay, good. It went down one basis point. I was flipped backwards there for a second. My bad. Okay, good. We want to see them all trend down. You've got financial activity stable, information at 6%. Yeah, that went down. That went down. Trade. Yep, all of them went down. Construction, 6.7 versus 6.9, 5.9 versus 6.2, 6.4 versus 6.8. Yeah, this is fantastic. So, yep, there it is. Pay gains slowed again in June. Slowest pace of growth since October of 2021. This is fantastic. I mean, it's great. Of course, the market is going to initially price in some concern because it means rates are going up, right? It means you have to start pricing in your next rate increase. But broadly, you have to look at it this way. We've priced in multiple more rate hikes from what we expected at the beginning of the year. We didn't think at the beginning of the year we were going to get to 5%. At least markets didn't. Then we got hot data in January. We got volatility in March because of that, along with the banking crisis. Even before the banking crisis in February, you had stocks sell down as we had to price in higher rates. So initially, when you get strong economic data, the first algorithmic response is crap, bad. That means more rate hikes. That means higher cost of capital. That means squeezing the economy more. That means J-Pow is basically coming up to you going, squeezing a little harder. Of course the market's going to turn red. That is the natural reaction of, yay, you know, more rate hikes. But you have to remember, this is actually really good because it tells you the economy is that much further away from recession. The further away we are from recession, the better. Here's what is this Logan commentary? Let's listen to this.
Because to give it a little more time, she's concerned whether inflation will return to target in a sustainable and timely way. She says the pace of labor market rebalancing remains slower than she expected and than forecasters expected. There's no indication, she said, of abrupt deterioration of the labor market. She's skeptical, and this is important. Logan comes to the Dallas Fed from having run the New York Fed monetary policy desk. So she was steeped in these issues of crises and financial crisis. First, no indication about large lagged effects from prior rate hikes. She says basically it's already in the market or in the economy right now, already had a fair amount of time to see the overall effects. Wow. She says housing markets looks to have bottomed, and housing rebound could cause upside risk to inflation. The outlook for above target inflation, she says, and the strong labor market could calls for more restrictive monetary policy. And this is important. Tighter credit conditions, she's judged, are unlikely to offset the need for higher rates. And again, that issue we talked about, the rebuilding of the Treasury general account by $1 trillion, not created liquidity pressure, she says. So the three
have
stayed the Fed's hand, lagged effects, tighter credit conditions, rebuilding the Treasury account. She's dismissing those as reasons
not to
stop. What
about that whole story you just told us?
She's not on board with that. She wants to see in the data. Look, I told you it was a story. It was something that the data explains it. And I know we got a great, great guy who's going to talk about this stuff coming up. And I don't want to.
She makes some Kevin.
Yep. And that is Meet Kevin. So, bottom line, there's some questions here. Should we be concerned about this? Is it buy the dip? Obviously, your personal allocations, totally up to you, right? But my take is that this, the market that we're in, is likely to see almost all dips bought by institutions. In fact, that's what we just talked about earlier on the channel, is that institutions are underallocated stocks, and so you're creating a floor that when you get dips, you get buying pressure because of either FOMO or an underallocation or the opportunity cost. Even though bond yields are high and they continue to rise, part of that is actually a cause of people dumping those bonds, driving yields up, and then allocating to stocks. So, but again, of course, the market's initial reaction has to be down because algorithmically, that's the way it works. If Fed rate hike bets go up, market go down. That's how it's worked for the last 18 months. And that's been the easiest trade ever. But consistently, what's happened over the last 6 months is that we don't care anymore about the rate hikes. What we actually care about is avoiding a recession and avoiding an earnings recession to the extent or more than the extent that we've already priced in an earnings recession. You don't want a recession. These numbers today say no recession. They also say no wage price spiral. They are a red flag for the potential that core inflation ends up surprising up because of more than expected spending on leisure, hospitality, hotels, flights, and all that crap. But that will be temporary. That will be bad news between basically early August and mid-October. That's when you get your inflation reports for July through September. That's probably when you get your potential bad news. You get past that. Now you get past the summer travel season. And if inflation continues to trend down and there's no recession or it's delayed substantially, it's all great news. Again, I'm not trying to like put on like rose-colored glasses here. I'm like, people are like, whoa, how could it be good news? We're not going into a recession. That is good news. Like, that's not rose-colored glasses. It's good news. You don't want to go into a recession. So, you know, it's a good thing. This report absolutely does not point to a recession, which is fantastic. So I think it's great. Now, by the way, I want to just throw this in here really quick because I know some of you have been curious about this. MP Material emailed me a little angry yesterday because I tweeted about them. And so I wanted to address that and just put it out there. So yesterday, China talked about banning certain rare earth exports that are needed in chips to America. It's basically like a tit-for-tat slapback at America. And so I tweeted the following. How ironic. MP Materials jumping on Beijing restricting exports of rare earth metals. Yet 90% of MP Materials revenue comes from a Chinese company. So people are investing in the United States MP Materials, thinking they're getting U.S. rare earths, yet those rare earths are just going to China anyway. Okay? And then I tweeted this, which is the receipt, which is literally from their Q1 earnings report of this year. That's their words, not mine. As of March 31st, 2023, Shenghe was the company's principal customer and accounted for more than 90% of product sales. So anyway, they emailed me and they're like, dude, come on, man. Like, that's phase one. And when we get to phase two, we're not going to sell 90% of our stuff to China anymore. And I'm like, cool. How about a factory tour or like a mine tour and an interview and we could talk about it? And they're like, yeah, we could do that after we transition to phase two. And I'm like, okay, cool. When are you guys transitioning? And they said, we're not ready yet. We'll let you know. I'm like, okay. So in other words, for the time being, you are going to still sell 90% of your stuff to China. And that's okay. But like, don't get mad at me for pointing it out. I think they're mad because I'm pointing out what is literally on their disclosures. Like, I'm reading their report. Like, don't get mad at me for that. It is what it is. But if you're going to say, like, hey, like, that's going to change when we get to phase two, fantastic. That's great. That is good news. But you're not there yet. So anyway, wanted to add that in. But again, bottom line, all this recession stuff, kick the can down the road. Recession is a good thing. Now, Goal here says, Kevin, I work for the largest trucking company that's going on strike.
Does it rhyme with UPS?
Anyway, the raises are huge. What we get, other trucking companies follow. Have to make a deal by Og1. Like, how huge are we talking here? Are we talking like 6%? Wait. Actually, are we talking trade, transportation, utilities? Are we talking 6.3%? Anyway, all right. Very well. So, next up. All right. Sup, Steve. Good to see you again. China controls the rare earth processing and refining. Heck yeah. Maybe I should go visit China. I worry if I ever went to China, they'd just like throw me in jail. I don't know. Like, I do try to be realistic about China. But I think sometimes that comes across as somewhat negative. I actually, you know, I am highly concerned that China's growth is going to be very, very, very bad. Way below expectations. And that's going to be an anchor for inflation going forward. Yeah. What do I think about Threads? We really going to go there? I guess so. Let me see if I could tell you. Wait, why tell if I could show? Okay, hold on. All right. Stand by. All right. Can I do it? All right, yeah. All right, Threads. Yeah, I'm on Threads because I have an Instagram account, and the sign-up process is really easy if you have an Instagram account. They, in fact, already carry over your verification. You don't have to pay for it. It's great. There are some cool benefits of that. I like the integration with Instagram. I like how easy it is to enroll and sign up. And this is what my Threads look like. It looks like. And I'll tell you, it feels like a copy and paste of Twitter. I mean, you've got the little heart emoji, you've got the comment button, and then instead of retweet, which is the same icon here, it's just repost or quote. Then, of course, you could share. One of the things that I've noticed is like the spacing between the icons doesn't look perfect. Like, it feels like the pixel spacing isn't great there, so I was a little surprised by that. But if I go to add, like, a video here or whatever, let's try to add this 10-minute, 24-second video. I do notice that I get an error. Video too long, try using a shorter clip. So I can't put my YouTube videos there. I did notice as well that obviously they don't have something like Twitter Spaces. So you're limited to shorter videos. You don't have some of the Spaces functionality. I think there's and the Financial Times just reported that Facebook signed up like 10 million users, which probably because of that easy on-ramp for Threads, you're getting a very like rapid acceleration of people signing up for this. I also think there's anytime there's a new social media app, you get this massive rush of people going in because they want to like, you know, make sure they get their username that they want. But anyway, is this actually a Twitter killer? I highly doubt it. I think it's going to be, you know, all these apps go through a hype phase and then they slowly bleed down. I do think that Zuck offers a very different personality, though, of leadership. Consider the difference between Elon Musk and Zuck for a moment. You know, Zuck is going to be more of your, potentially, dare I say, rule follower, a little bit less of your sort of cowboy like Elon Musk, rule breaker, maybe a little bit more of a rule follower, you know, really hard-lined about free speech at Twitter, which I think everybody should be. But they're obviously within the limits of the law, which Elon mostly agrees with, but that certainly attracted more of a conservative audience, whereas on Threads, I think you might have more of a refuge for people who don't necessarily agree with all the values of Elon and Twitter, which has definitely leaned more conservative. So you kind of have your choices here, you know, sort of like pick your poison, like what do you want? You know, there's goods and bads on each side. Am I jumping up and down to go post on Threads every day? No. You know, am I going to use it and play around in it? And you know, should you follow me to see whatever silly stuff I put there? Sure, absolutely. Well, I also think you should follow me on Instagram, right? So you can look at my stories. Like yesterday, I should have posted more stories yesterday. Yesterday, I flew to Phoenix, quick day trip to Phoenix. Phoenix area was one town of it, Deer Valley area. And it's fantastic. Great area. Looked at the TSM facilities and real estate, rentals, hoarder houses, you know, whatever, the usual stuff. And, I like to share stories like that, which what I've actually noticed is YouTube, I think, got rid of their ability to post stories. So you can't post stories anymore on YouTube. You can't post stories anymore on Twitter because they got rid of that feature. So the only place you could post stories would be like Snapchat, which I don't use, or Instagram. So, you know, Instagram has this. I'm shocked YouTube got rid of the stories. But anyway, Instagram has it. But, you know, unless they could, like, I think it'd be cool if they linked those stories to your threads. That would be a cool feature. But other than that, right now, it just feels like a discount Twitter until they actually roll out some unique features. And I hate to say it, but it does feel a lot like Elon Musk spent $44 billion for something that Mark, to a large extent, just copy and pasted. Kind of wild. Unfortunately, unless Threads really, takes off and creates its own base, you'll probably just get a lot of duplicative stuff that gets posted on Twitter and then gets duplicated on Threads. But that's probably going to lead to a lower quality discussion, lower quality content across the board. So we'll see what happens. Anyway, my thoughts on Threads. All right, so now what? Double count users for earnings. That's true. As far as Facebook earnings, that's a good point. You know, now your monthly active users and daily active user numbers could potentially double count, depending on how you end up counting this. That is a very good point. I hadn't thought about that. I'm not the biggest fan of investing in Meta anyway, mostly because I hate that a lot of the money gets dumped into the Reality Labs division. But that's okay. You know, there are plenty of good companies to invest in. I'm not saying Facebook isn't. It's just not for me. So anyway, okay. So that covers this. What's next? Let's listen to CNBC for a moment. And we'll see what's next.
Futures, you've been looking at the 10-year. You saw yields rise pretty rapidly, too. Anyway, folks, that does it for us today. Make sure you join us tomorrow.
Friday.
It is Friday. Squawk on the Street begins right now. We'll see you later.
Good Thursday morning. Welcome to Squawk on the Street. I'm Carl Quintanilla with Jim Cramer at Post 9 at the New York Stock Exchange. David Faber has the morning off. Pre-market is stumbling here as the job market data comes in extremely hot. ADP doubles expectations and yields are crossing some important lines. 10-year above 4, first time since March. 2-year, a fresh 16-year high. Our roadmap's going to begin with that macro outlook. ADP shatters expectations, futures falling on the news. The Treasury Secretary begins her China visit, landing in Beijing early today, looking to calm some tensions. And Meta, as you know, officially launching Threads. Millions join, but will it prove to be a Twitter killer? Let's begin, though, with the markets here. Jim, you tweeted this morning that you didn't like the feel.
No,
now, what does this data do?
Simmy's yesterday. I mean, we're just in a... Wow, the data's just really bad. I mean, if ADP is right, which is that almost a half million people got jobs, there's been some geographic areas that aren't so strong. South surprisingly wasn't as strong, but I mean, I don't think anyone's set up yet, particularly if they trade treasuries, for what remains a boom. I mean, I've been saying it's not a hard landing, not a soft landing. It's a takeoff. This is a takeoff. Now, no one expects that. It's not supposed to happen. There's a couple of recommendations of Toll Brothers and Pulte. And typically, like, the new thing, and I'm going to savage these people tonight. Not savage. I'm going to say that perhaps they're ill-advised. Are these people who have price targets for home builders, and the price target's like 40 points away, and they raise them by 7. They have to do that every day from now to kingdom come. So there is just 497 versus 220. There are very few people who are that off.
Yeah. ADP is a remarkable print. Now, granted.
All right. Let's talk about the next thing that we have here. So, all right. Where was it? It was right over here.
Got it. Yes. Yes.
All right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, you might not believe this, but the government is now trying to fight to continue censoring you. As somebody who ran for governor of California and got to see a little bit of the inner workings of the political system and experienced censorship firsthand, this is blatantly disgusting. And this is not Democratic or Republican. This is just straight up an American belief that the government should not be censoring American opinion, especially when there's dissent. Because dissent actually generally makes us think a little bit. Wait, are we wrong in what we're saying? Can we fact check what we're saying? Think about it. When you write something on Twitter, perhaps, or you make a comment, and then somebody says, well, what about this? It makes you think. And it's like, oh, never thought about it that way, potentially. Or, oh, maybe I'm wrong. That's a good thing. That's very healthy. But if nobody else is able to respond, that's a problem. And so, obviously, we had this legal ruling that came out on July 4th, perfectly timed, where a federal judge restricted the government's ability to censor individuals on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and other forms of social media. In fact, this judge went as far as calling the government's actions today dystopian in nature, or to date, dystopian in nature, almost to the level of the Ministry of Truth, and that the judge believes that those alleging the government had censored them have potentially provided enough evidence to support that the government has been engaging in a far-reaching and widespread censorship campaign. When we last covered this, before this breaking news came out of what the government's doing now, we gave examples of basically going through this, about how the White House is flagging stuff on Twitter and YouTube and trying to get vaccine skeptical content censored, or even information about gas prices and the economy censored. Tucker Carlson censored, Tommy Lahren censored. All of these essentially people potentially disagreeing with information the White House is putting out requested to be censored. So, what's happening now? Well, here you go. Look at what just happened. Notice of appeal. After this ruling, you quite literally have President Joe Biden, in his official capacity as President of the United States, sorry, this is a little blurry copy over here. Anyway, the Biden administration filing an appeal. All defendants hereby appeal to the preliminary injunction, which limits the government's ability to censor you. So the injunction limits the government's ability to censor you. The defendants, aka the Joe Biden administration, the Biden administration, are like, No. We want to appeal that so we can continue to control messaging about the economy or whatever we want. That to me is even almost scarier than the fact that the stuff happened. It's like, okay, the stuff happened. That's scary already. The censorship happened. That's bad. But now not only did the censorship happen, but now you're literally embarking on a fight to make sure you could continue that style of censorship. That's mind-blowing to me. It makes me want to remind you to get life insurance in as little as 5 minutes by going to metkevin.com/life. Or check out the links to Shadow Me, link down below, or the courses on building your wealth, paid promotion on life insurance. Anywho, I'm very surprised by this. I guess then again, maybe we shouldn't be surprised. Maybe it's become so ingrained in the fabric of our governmental organizations to essentially argue for controlling messaging that this is the next step. It's just, no, let's keep fighting it in court. I mean, to some extent, if an injunction is like, don't censor, and you're like, all right, we'll stop censoring, you don't need to appeal. I mean, maybe I'm missing something. Maybe there's another reason to appeal. But it seems to me, if the injunction is don't censor, and you're appealing, you're basically saying, no, we want to keep doing what we're doing. Which is scary, because that's kind of like what China does, right? I mean, China and North Korea, these essentially near dictatorships, or communist party regimes are controlling messaging. They, you know, the websites are censored. You can't get all access to, free and truthful information and transparent press and transparent media because the messaging is controlled. It's kind of like how Russia tries to control the narrative as well. Somebody writes a piece located in Russia that they don't like, they arrest the person. Like they arrested the individual who works for the Wall Street Journal. Evan, I think it was. Terrible. Write a bad piece about how Russia's losing the war, boom, you're thrown in jail. It's not how a government is supposed to work. And the fact that our government is now appealing the censorship somewhat makes me feel like they're trying to go in that direction, which is really scary. And I'm not trying to be like, tinfoil hat, fear-mongery, slippery slopey here, but I just don't see a defense for that. And again, I don't think it's Dem or Republican or whatever. I think it's just politics. I've been so used to controlling the narrative for so long and potentially controlling the media that finally we're getting more a mainstream adoption of free speech and free opinion and people making their own conclusions that you almost have this sense of panic at the government. Anyway, pretty crazy. So wanted to give you an update on that and we'll keep an eye on it because it's pretty wild. All right, next. Let's see. What do they got over here?
Lost cause. Monday, maybe.
Right, it's a lost cause. I think they just sit here and play the market, or they play Call of Duty. Thank you, Bobby Kotick. Or maybe they garden, but they ain't working.
Yeah. We mentioned the Treasury Secretary this morning beginning her four-day visit to China. She did arrive in Beijing a couple of hours ago. Eunice Yun is on the ground with what to expect. Hi, Eunice.
Hey, Carl. Well, the Treasury Secretary, as you said, has arrived in Beijing, and it looks as though she's going to have a very long day ahead of her on Friday. A senior Treasury official said for her first day of meetings, she's going to be sitting down with the former Vice Premier Liu He, a familiar face to the West, as he is the one who helped negotiate the U.S. trade deal for the Chinese under the Trump administration. She's going to attend a business roundtable hosted by the American Chamber of Commerce here. And she was also going to have a bilateral with the premier, Li Qiang, and then end her day with a dinner hosted by the former central bank governor, Zhou Shuaichan.
Okay, Fed terminal rate just popped up again to 5.426. That's another 2.6 in there.
Hope to improve the communication between the U.S. and China, which is a greater effort on the part of the Biden administration. The topics that are going to be covered are going to be some of them are stickier issues, such as China's trade practices, as well as areas where they hope to find common ground. And this is on debt distress in poor nations or climate change. The senior Treasury official said that so far, they don't expect any specific policy breakthroughs for her trip, and that they hope that the conversations in Beijing will be frank and productive. In fact, The official said that that is their expectation. Now, on the Chinese side, based on official commentary as well as state media reports, the Chinese are seeking what they call signs of U.S. sincerity. So that is some combination of a reduction or an end of the Trump-era tariffs on Chinese goods, lifting the sanctions on Chinese companies and individuals, and stopping the export curbs. Now, the Chinese argument has been that these tariffs would just exacerbate U.S. inflation, that some of these curbs, Carl, would be bad for U.S. companies as well. But the view is that Yellen is a very pragmatic person, and that at the end of the day, she might go back to Washington with a similar message as the Chinese.
Interesting. We do have NXP today, and Taiwan Semi saying no material effect, Jim, from those metals restrictions anyway.
No, look, I think that this is an important mission from the point of view of the Chinese recognizing that they need us more than they used to. I mean, if you think about it, the reshoring, yeah. The moving to Vietnam, it's taking time, but it's beginning to work. If you listen to Nike in their somewhat suboptimal conference call, you do understand that what's happened is if you're moving away from China and you're also selling.
It's because of discounting at Nike. I mean, he's not wrong. I mean, we went through the earnings call as well in the course member live stream, and there was quite a bit of talk about discounting, let's just say, which is actually, again, great. It's one of the reasons, look, we love earnings season in the course member live streams. Well, at least I do. I mean, hopefully everybody does. I mean, thousands of you watch the course member live streams every day, so hopefully we're on the right track here. But when we go through earnings season, we get to see what's really going on. And I mean, just what we've seen consistently has been such a good leading indicator of just inflation continuing to trend down. Hopefully we continue on that pace. But, Nike was definitely a tell that, yes, we are on that pace. It's also surprising, I finally convinced Lauren to get the best mommy car in the world. Obviously, a Mercedes Sprinter van. And, we went to the Mercedes dealership, I don't know, like 3 days ago. And I was expecting, it was going to be like a 9 to 12 month wait. And we're like, how long of a wait for a 144, I think it's a 144, 140, 144 wheelbase or whatever, 12 passenger configuration for a Sprinter. And they're like, well, for the extended model, we have some supply chain issues still because of the bench manufacturer not being able to catch up or whatever. But let me check the inventory. So he goes in the inventory and Lauren's like, oh, I want the, Amazon truck color one or whatever. And he's like, all right, let me check the inventory. And he looks and he goes, oh, it looks like there's an Amazon truck colored one, 12 passenger van configuration, with the blind spot and all this kind of junk or whatever, coming in 2 weeks. And then it takes about another week for it to get here. And nobody's name is on it. So I could tentatively put your name on it. And I'm like, we walked in here expecting to wait 9 months. You're telling me we could have it within 3 weeks. We don't even need it in 3 weeks. And he's like, yeah. I'm like, oh, okay. But regarding the mommy van part, since obviously people are asking about it now. Look, we have a Toyota Sienna. Toyota Sienna is great. It's 8 passengers, but the 8th seat is tiny. And when you use all 8 seats, it's first of all, crammed. Like, for you to get to the last row is a pain in the butt. It's very, you're climbing over seats or you're climbing in through the trunk to get to the last row. It's a pain in the butt. And then you actually don't have that much storage left in the back. It's decent, but not for 8 people. So with a 12-passenger van, you've got more trunk space, substantially more trunk space, standing room, and you could actually separate these kids who just literally want to, kill each other. And I feel like that's what they're, designed for, is, they're just trying to kill each other. So it's like, if you have 12 seats, at least you could, separate, the 7-year-old and the 5-year-old, because they're crazy, and then keep them separated from the little twin girls that are on the way. Knock on wood, anatomy scan was great yesterday, which is a pretty important part about halfway through pregnancy, so knock on wood, it's going good. But, need a bigger car. This is why Tesla needs to make something like that.
I told Lauren we need a bus. 12 seat. the 12 passenger van is actually very reasonable. Because you can still drive it around almost like a normal car. It's a little tall, so you have problems with like parking structures, but other than that, it's very reasonable for parking. You can get the extended version. That one's a little bit of a pain. You need like two parking spots. But anyway, no, they're not $200K. It was like $56,000, which is like, it's still an expensive car. Don't get me wrong, but it's not $200K. It's not like a, you know, converted camper van or whatever. It's like literally just a passenger van. So it's actually not unreasonable. I mean, you get a decked out Sprinter versus a decked out Sienna, you're not that far apart actually anymore, and you're getting way more functionality for a Mercedes Sprinter van. It's pretty cool. So yeah. Anyway, we'll call that the family planning and new car update or whatever we want to call that. I think it's something everybody should consider if they've got, you know, a need for more space. And then you can also take out that 12, that 8, the 9, 10, 11, 12 row, and then you have even more storage space in the back. But, I mean, just go to mbvans.com if you haven't done it before. Mercedes-Benz vans. They're actually really cool. So, you know, here you go. They're a passenger van starting at 55A. So, okay, it's probably closer to 65 then once you put all the stuff in. But, you know, whatever. So these are the different wheelbases here. And usually you want to get the high one. It's the 144. The 170 is the one that takes the two parking spots. So you'd be something like this. And, yeah, okay, then you have the different build-outs here or whatever. So it looks like it goes up to about 69K. I thought the one they priced was like, it ended in a 5, and it wasn't in the 70s. So it was either 65 or 55. Looking at this now, it must have been $65,000. But anyway, you know, something like this, you know, slap a cool color on there here, like an Amazon truck color or whatever. There you go. It's pretty functional for a family, frankly. Do they show the inside of these suckers? You get all this crap, options and stuff like that, whatever. Here. Sprinter van 12 seat configuration 144 wheelbase. That's the amount of, I think it's inches between the two wheels, the front axle and the back axle. Anyway, this shows you the configuration. Yeah, this is actually it. There it is. Oh, there it is. So it's just a little pixelated. That's the 12 passenger configuration with the high roof here. So you still get your trunk space over here as a Sprinter, which is fantastic. And then you get your 12 seats. You could, if you were like, if I told Lauren, like, if you really want to be a badass, get the extended one, the 15 passenger van, which has even another row in it. But here you have 2 3-seat rows and then a 4-seat row. And you actually have room to get to the different rows. You don't have to climb over another row to get to the back row, which is nice. But yeah, these are some of the most functional vehicles that exist. If you ever even need like a, you know, cargo van too, these things are just phenomenal vehicles. I once owned this one, the extended, which is basically the long version stretched out another 18 inches. It's pretty badass how much room there is in it. I mean, it's like having your own moving truck almost at that point. So, yeah, they don't actually make the extended for passengers anymore, but yeah, big fan of that. You get a wrap it. Probably not. just me on the side. Meet Kevin. Anyway, I got to make another cup of coffee, and then I'm going to go to the course member live stream, so I'll see you all soon. Thanks so much for being here, and cheers. Bye.